President Trump and Vladimir Putin met in Anchorage, Alaska earlier this year to much fanfare that the idea that hopefully you get the two heads of state of the two biggest nuclear powers on the planet together, we can finally find a way to end this Ukraine-Russia war. That was the hope back then. We have now seen that in the immediate aftermath, you may recall right after it was, Trump was all excited. They said that there would be a bilateral meeting between Zelensky and Putin shortly thereafter, and then a trilateral, including Trump, right after that. And possibly by the end of August, we would have the war to a conclusion. That's what Trump said. That's what he had promised during the 2024 campaign, had promised again at the beginning of his term here. And that seemed to be the crowning moment that now that we're ready for some action, some real tangible results, and nothing happened. In fact, since that time, things have deteriorated, possibly worse than they were before President Trump came into office. And now it appears, I think pretty conclusively, that whatever hopes and motivations we had at that time have been lost. Now, unfortunately, in the absence of even that hope, is now a creeping possibility that we could be heading back into the escalation and the war between NATO and Europe and Russia that we have long concerned ourselves about and wanted this war to be over. To avoid that, we seem to be drifting in that direction. To try to help us make some sense out of that, we have the show popular ever great guest, Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, leader over at the Sonar21.com, son of New American Revolution on Substack, obviously dresser connoisseur of excellence with his shirt selection, Larry Johnson. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you.
Listen, you know, there was a lot of hope. Well, I won't say a lot of hope. There was some hope that maybe this Alaska thing could turn into something. We kind of gave it the best shot, but I mean, aside from what I'm going to show you, some other people are saying in both Russia and Europe today, what are your thoughts on where we are now versus where we might possibly have been in August?
Trump and his advisors aren't listening to Russia. And Russia knows what it's has made its position very clear. They're moving forward. So look, they're willing to achieve a diplomatic settlement, but it's going to be on Russia's terms. It's not going to be on U.S. terms or European terms or Ukrainian terms. It's going to be on Russian terms. Those terms right now are very straightforward. Crimea, Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, those are now permanently part of the Russian Federation. They're not going back, no reversal. And the world needs to acknowledge that, accept that as number one. Number two, get all NATO troops, NATO advisors, et cetera, the hell out of Ukraine. And Ukraine is not going to join NATO, will not be a part of it. And Ukraine's army needs to be scaled down. They need to have a national police force. And that's what Russia wants now. If that is not met, Russia's demands are going to increase. And regardless of what the West does, Russia is going to achieve its goals. And the inability of Trump and his advisors to comprehend that is just, they're either deaf, dumb, or they're deliberately ignoring what the Russians are saying. There is a path. There's a pathway to peace. But it's not the one that the West wants.
Well, you say that we don't listen to the West, or the West doesn't listen to Russia because they've been saying a lot of these things. Well, they're saying some additional things here. And in terms specifically about the Alaska hope, Sergei Ryabkov, the deputy foreign minister, said this overnight.
К сожалению, приходится констатировать, что мощный импульс Анкориджа в пользу договоренности оказался в значительной мере исчерпан. Это результат деструктивной деятельности, прежде всего. Что касается непосредственно томагавков, то, как вы понимаете, без программного обеспечения, без пусковых установок, ракеты сами по себе – это, скажем так, болванки. Гипотетическое применение таких систем возможно только с прямым задействованием американского персонала. Я надеюсь, глубину и тяжесть последствий принимаемого в этой ситуации того или иного решения.
So everybody, when they talk, they always talk about their perspective and things from their viewpoint. Sometimes they exaggerate some things. Sometimes they outright deceive, etc. So you always have to look at everything with an open mind and a bit of a grain of salt. But let's take a look at what he said there. Yeah. He said that the impetus from Anchorage, Alaska had been lost, and then he had primarily attributed to the Europeans. Is that truth or is that exaggeration?
No, I think it's true. I've spoken, met with, and spoken with Sergei Ryabkov back in December of 2023, and during that conversation, he emphasized at the time the problem was, he says, we don't have anybody to talk to in the U.S. government. He said, we're open to talk, but the Biden administration's shutting us out. So now enter Trump. And Mr. Ryabkov was noting that they had hopes out of the Alaska meeting that this was going to open a pathway to dialogue. Now, if anything, he was soft pedaling, blaming the Americans. It's easy to pin it all on the Europeans. But the reality is Donald Trump and his crew, there's a number of things they could do. They could lift the restrictions on Soviet consulates being able to obtain a visa to go to Russia, number one, because they shut down a couple of the consulates. They could return the property that was illegally seized by Barack Obama in December of 2016. They could put together these working groups that they were supposed to put together to talk about a variety of issues of how to improve, for example, reopening direct travel from the United States to Russia. Instead, you've got to go through this convoluted process, fly from the U.S. to Istanbul in Turkey, Doha in Qatar, or Dubai in order to catch a connecting flight to Moscow. So what used to be a 9-hour trip is now like a 25-hour trip. So there's been no progress. Trump, Trump and his team, good talkers, and you're seeing, a little bit of the Russian frustration with that, but they're still not willing to blame it all on the United States. So they pin it on the Europeans because nobody likes the Europeans. No, the Europeans don't like the Europeans.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to that in a minute, but let's examine your thesis here on the American side. Obviously, Trump came in promising he'd get this solved in a day. It would be easy. I know Putin. I know Zelensky. I know what's going on with this war, and I know how to bring it to an end. Well, obviously, that didn't happen.
Right.
So then we had Alaska. That took a long time, and then nothing happened after that. But now here recently, it's not just been kind of static. There has been a change in the Trump administration. One of the complaints that many often made of the Biden administration was that Zelensky or the Ukraine or the Europeans would ask for certain weapon systems. They would try to get them. Biden would initially say no, that he would drag his feet and then eventually say yes. And it would be this long, convoluted time. They'd get them, but it turned out, to be much later than anybody wanted them, and usually in smaller numbers. Well, now here's one that up to this point, I'd never heard anyone talking about. Now, all of a sudden, the Trump administration itself brings in, and Sergei Ryabkov mentioned it there, the Tomahawk issue. So what is, from your understanding, why would the administration at this point introduce the idea of potentially Tomahawk missiles into the war here?
Desperation. Look, this we got insight into the delusional state, not just of the Trump administration, but of the Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Defense. Cy Hirsch put out an article about a week ago and essentially describing the stalemate, that the where the war in Ukraine is going. And he was presenting what he had heard from a senior source in the Trump administration. Now, I don't know if it's a political type. My guess is, knowing Cy, he's got contacts at DOD and at CIA, and he's hearing this from them. And what they're describing is a situation that does not exist. They're describing, oh man, Russia, this is a stalemate. The war is a stalemate. And it's like, do you even understand what the term stalemate means? That it implies that, oh, Russia advances 5 kilometers one day, and then the next day Ukraine advances, takes those 5 kilometers back, and there's just a seesaw battle back and forth. Nobody's gaining any advantage. I mean, that's just a load of horse manure. Because what we've seen is Russia is advancing and taking 2 to 3 villages a day now. Not a month, but a day. The advances all along that front are accelerating, not decelerating. And then these sources in the administration also told Cy Hirsch, and that this is what they're telling Donald Trump, and he's repeating it. Oh, the Russian economy, man, it's, oh my God. These Ukrainian drone attacks have just destroyed the Russian economy. Their oil, they're running out of gas. People are lining up. There's shortages everywhere. The economy's collapsing. It's just a damn lie. I've got 5 different sources in Russia. 4 of them are American expats. One's a West Point graduate. One left the U.S. Army as a major after serving for 11 years. Okay, one is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and one is just what somebody got fed up with the decline of values in the United States and moved to Russia with family. None of them corroborate any of this. They're going, you know, when I share with them, they're going, "What are you talking about? That's crazy." So, but the fact is, you've got these people in DOD, CIA, and in the Trump administration that believe this nonsense. And so once you start from a position of false belief, it's like if I convince you, hey, Danny, look, I've got these 2 pillows, tie them to your arms and flap real hard, and then I'm going to push you off the 30-story building, and you'll land softly. Now, I know you. You're not dumb enough to believe me, but that's what's happening with the Trump administration. They're dumb enough to believe that they can put the pillows on their arms, flap them real hard, and that when they hit the ground at 32 feet per second squared after falling, 200 feet, that it's going to be a soft landing. So, I mean, it's delusional.
Yeah, and there is lots of that, unfortunately. But that's not where the delusion ends. And even specifically related to this Tomahawk issue, I want to see. So you saw in that first comment there that Sergei Ryabkov initially talked about the loss of the momentum since Anchorage, but then he also turned to the issue of the Tomahawk missiles. Right. And he said, because this would require the direct participation of the United States, he said this could potentially be a new level of crisis if it actually comes to be. There has been some attempts by Western so-called experts to soft pedal that and say that's actually not the case. Here is, I think this was from earlier today, maybe it was yesterday, from Mr. Clark at Sky News, who said, actually, no, you don't need the Americans to fire those things.
It can be operated without American personnel. I mean, there might be some American personnel involved in maintenance of Tomahawks, but that can be done in Poland, even if that's required. But, I mean, Tomahawk missiles are missiles. I mean, we operate them. The United Kingdom operates them quite happily from our submarines, and we can carry them from aircraft, although we, generally speaking, we don't, but we use them on our submarines, and they're available. It's a closed weapon system. When you've got the weapon, there it is. There's the way you program it. Now, American help in programming targeting goes on all the time, yes. So that's no different. If Tomahawks were used by the Ukrainians, does that mean American personnel in Ukraine? No, it doesn't at all.
Yeah, sure. It doesn't mean, as long as you have ballistic submarines that can fire missiles or American bombers, then yeah, sure, you wouldn't have to actually have that like the UK does. But as is pointed out here in this Business Insider article on this very topic here, they point out that it's unclear how Ukraine would launch the Tomahawks if it got them. The missiles are fired from vertical launch system cells on warships, torpedo tubes from submarines, and the ground launchers like the Army's Typhoon system. Kiev lacks all of these. So you see black and white. No, you don't have to really be an expert, but it's weird that Michael Clark would be making that claim, that he even talks about how the UK could do it without the US, right, mostly because it has those platforms. Ukraine doesn't, but then he still says, but they could do it without. What do you make of that?
Well, again, this is this is really dangerous territory. This is the first time we've heard the Russians establish a bright red line with regards to a weapon system. You know, when the United States introduced the HIMARS into theater, and again, the HIMARS require U.S. assistance as well to launch and operate. The Russians didn't say, will view that as crossing a line and will raise the prospect of retaliation. They didn't say that with the HIMARS. They didn't say it with the ATACMS. They haven't said it with the Storm Shadow in terms of what, you know, what the Brits have launched. And they haven't even said it with respect to Taurus, but they're now saying it with respect to the Tomahawk missile.
If you could put that headline up there, this is from today's news, not that one, the one from the, I think it's Reuters, where they're talking about, yeah, if you use these, we'll pull it up here in a second. It's one of the Russian lawmakers. Says Russia will destroy the Tomahawk missiles and their launchers if the U.S. gives them to Ukraine. What that means is because they know that they'll destroy the American military forces operating them. So first of all, let me make sure you read it that way. And second, if they do, can we stop them?
Yes, they will. No, we can't. There is a report came out 2 days ago. This one channel called Borzikman. He reported that the HIMARS battery that was destroyed on Monday, I believe, that was actually crewed by a group of Army Rangers. Now, we haven't had any independent confirmation of that. But beyond that, you had Putin say that if the United States does this, it's going to force a reevaluation and assessment in the relationship with Washington. So, and the reason is simple. These are nuclear-capable weapon systems. Now, the fact is that the ground launch systems for the Tomahawk were reconfigured, you know, I understand like 15, 20 years ago, so that they could not currently, in their current condition, carry a nuke. But the Russians don't want to be in the position of having to guess, does it have a nuke or does it not? So they're going to assume, we've just got to assume that it's a nuke. Now, a lot of this may just be, irresponsible talk on the part of Washington, because they actually don't have the supplies.
Right.
It's not like sitting there with a stockpile of them in a warehouse and say, "Oh boy, we got to get rid of these, or they're going to go bad." No, they'll be more often than not scrambling around looking for one. Now, the truth of the matter is, as Putin made clear at the Valdai speech, I guess it was the last Thursday or Friday, he said, if they shoot them, we'll shoot them down. Well, we've got the ability. They're not as daunting, perhaps, as say the
attack. That's a lot older technology.
Yeah, it's about 50 years old. You know, it's almost as old as you and me.
But, man, I didn't know it was that old.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, it was high speed, low drag back in the 70s, as were bell bottom jeans and disco. But the world's moved on since then.
And one of the things that worries me, Larry, is that I fear that Trump is getting bad advice and information from his key staff, whoever those people that he trusts are. And I think that was, you can see some evidence of that in his speech that he made before the naval folks that in their 250th anniversary a couple of days ago, and on what he said when asked a question in the Oval Office recently. They said, "Have you made a decision on the Tomahawk thing?" And he said, "Yeah, pretty much have. But, I'd like to see what they plan on doing with it, et cetera." Yeah. Implying that he doesn't really understand the significance or whether they even can fire it because of those issues that I mentioned there. And then he bragged about, by the way, firing 30 Tomahawks against Iran early this year in that naval speech there, where he's talking about, and just for good measure, we, from our ballistic submarines, we launched another 30 Tomahawks. They all hit their targets, et cetera. I think he thinks that the same thing would happen here, that anything that Ukraine fired, whether it's via us or not, would strike their targets. And I don't think he's really aware of where things are in the nature of the Russians and the U.S. actually fighting each other as opposed to Iran.
Yeah. Well, and, those 30 that he fired into Iran, that's 30 fewer than the U.S. has.
And that too,
and if it's anything like the production of THAADs, we produce 50 THAAD missiles a year. So yeah, think of that. You fired 30 off. Okay. 20 you've used up in one attack. You use up two thirds of the supply for an entire year. It is the Tomahawk cruise missile is a weapon system designed for a world, a tactical world that no longer exists. And that's the thing that Trump and his advisors don't understand. You know, they're still living in the 20th century and not even capturing the lessons that we didn't learn. Yeah, we can beat the hell out of an army like Iraq, you know, a third rate army with no air power and no air defense systems to speak of. Yeah, boy, we can sure kick their ass. And yeah, Panama too, boy, we showed those Panamanians. So we're good at beating up the weak and the lame, well, and the infirm.
Apparently, as you pointed out many times, not so good even on the weak. Look at the Houthis, how'd that work out?
Yeah, the Houthis and Taliban are sitting back. Yeah, you know, yeah, those Americans are not quite as tough as they like to pretend. So, but again, it's divorced from this reality. So we think, well, let's just send one more weapon. And you know, you've made the point, and also with your discussions with Doug, that okay, so they launch a few Tomahawks. All that's going to do is irritate the hell out of the Russians. That's all it accomplishes. It doesn't degrade their military capability. It doesn't degrade their ability to produce weapons. It doesn't degrade their ability to provide supplies needed to fuel their industries. So it's like, what's the point? What is it that we're trying to do? And it's that lack of strategic understanding within the Trump administration. That they're only thinking tactically. They are not thinking strategically.
You know, I have some concerns, and hear me out here, that part of it may not be as much a lack of strategic understanding as it is more economic understanding about what this can mean and what the continued war means. Bear with me here for a second. Go to Ursula von der Leyen, because Rybakov mentioned there at the opening that he blamed the Europeans for not coming to a peaceful settlement here. And given the facts that you've talked about many times, the actual on-the-ground realities, the balance of power, all of that, it's irrational to continue supporting a war that cannot be won, that cannot even avoid being lost. I mean, it's even stronger than that, rationally speaking. And yet, this was, I want to say it was this morning, I think it was today, Ursula von der Leyen issued this dire warning about where things are heading.
Something new and dangerous is happening in our skies. In just the past 2 weeks, MiG fighters have violated Estonia's airspace, and drones have flown over critical sites in Belgium, Poland, Romania, Denmark, and Germany. Flights have been grounded, jets scrambled, and countermeasures deployed to ensure the safety of our citizens. Make no mistake, this is part of a worrisome pattern of growing threats. Across our union, undersea cables have been cut, airports and logistic hubs paralyzed by cyber attacks, and elections targeted by malign influence campaign. These incidents are calculated to linger in the twilight of deniability. This is not random harassment. It is a coherent and escalating campaign to unsettle our citizens, test our resolve, divide our union, and weaken our support for Ukraine. And it is time to call it by its name. This is hybrid warfare.
So there you have it. We are at warfare, and there's a couple of things I want to point out here, but the operative one is that she listed off this whole laundry list of things, giving the strong implication that they're coming out of nowhere. There's no reason for Russia to be doing this. It certainly can't have anything to do with our actions, and it's a consequence and a reaction to our actions. But no, this is just that Russia's doing all these things devoid of any context, meaning we need to be ready for war. That's the message here. What do you say?
Well, they need to be ready for war, but they're incapable of making those preparations. You know, if you go out and say, we're going to do a random survey, we're going to give people the opportunity. You can have dinner with Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, or François Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, or Friedrich Merz, the president of Germany, or you can have a colonoscopy. Most people would choose the colonoscopy, okay? It's that bad. You've got a complete separation, a widening gulf between the leadership of these NATO, many of these NATO countries, and I put Ursula von der Leyen. I don't call her von der Leyen. It's von der Leyen, which she did an excellent job right there. But she's in with that class, whereas the majority of the populations are going, we're not going to war. Wait a second. No. We're not doing that. So it's going to erupt at some point, that fissure. And her litany of all of these, quote, drone attacks. You saw the other day, they finally fessed up that one of these incursions were 10 balloons that had cigarettes attached to them. So they were smuggling cigarettes with weather balloons.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, which made me then in my mind, I started hearing the song by Nena. You remember the
99 Luftballons?
The 99 Luftballons, yeah. You know. And that should be like the theme song for what's going on right now. Because actually that song and the lyrics of it dealt with this sort of European madness with respect to war. So, yeah, okay, Europe, arm up, baby. Let's do it. Oh, except the president now of Slovakia, the president of the Czech Republic, President Orban of Hungary, they're saying, nah, we're not going along. You guys go have fun.
Yeah, we're not
playing.
We're going to get to that, actually, to many of those what you just mentioned here. But let me show you first that it's not just the Europeans, but there are still these neocon war lusters in the United States that seem to be behind this. As today's Washington Post had George Will, who's saying that, yeah, look, we are at war. He wrote today, this is just today, Russia has launched this torrent of aggressions. He mentioned some of the same things that Ursula von der Leyen did. The aggressed against still calls this hybrid or gray zone war. Erase the adjectives. This is war. He didn't even say gray zone war. He didn't even say cyber war. He said war. What if Russia's winning in Ukraine were only the beginning of the enfeeblement of the United States? Putin strolled down Donald Trump's red carpet in Alaska and then took none of the steps regarding Ukraine that Trump said were necessary for Russia to avoid very severe consequences. Instead, Putin intensified his Russian attacks. Now, this completely is oblivious to the fact that Russia came in at Alaska and said, we would love to solve this through diplomatic means. Here are the conditions, however, which were very draconian for the Ukraine side, but they're very open and honest about it publicly as well as privately. And we didn't want to go down that path. So, but the claim is that Russia just came in and just didn't listen to Trump. Like Trump was the lecturer and right. Or the daddy. And here's the, you know, the recalcitrant son or something. And he didn't obey. So what does that leave except for war? Where does that lead, though?
Well, for starters, with George Will, I wasn't even aware that he was still alive. I mean, he's a bow tie wearing buffoon. Obviously, he tied his bow tie too tight. It cut off the blood flow of oxygen to his brain for him to write something so ridiculous. You know, I dealt with the guy several, you know, whew, got 30 plus years ago. The arrogance is superseded only by the ignorance in that kind of statement. The provocation of the West in attacking Russia, you know, it extends back now 35 years, going with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the emergence of this new government. There were repeated efforts by Russia to work with, cooperate with, be included as part of the West. But the West is insistent upon destroying Russia for two reasons. One, to get access and control of all the abundant natural resources that Russia has. And number two, to use it as a springboard to go against China. That's it. So we don't give a damn about the Russian people. And so, you know, here's what Will trying to, you know, talk about the enfeeblement of the United States. Hey, George, newsflash, we're already there. We cannot produce enough artillery shells to keep the Ukrainian army supplied for 1 month, much less a year. How about drones? How are we doing on that front? Well, not too good, because it seems that we got this little trade problem with China, and they control many of the key components that we need for making the drones. So we're in the process of the United States losing its role as the dominant world leader, both economically. We lost that role militarily. We still, you know, have Trump pretending that we're this dominant military power. And, you know, as you correctly noted, we couldn't handle the Taliban and the Houthis. So
the Houthis.
Yeah.
Well, you say that that's the only thing, you know, it's that simple. It's just that China, it's a little bit more complicated and in some ways weird, because you correctly point out, we are not the arsenal of democracy like we, you know, were in World War II and claim to still be. There's no truth to that, because we can't physically produce the stuff. You correctly right. identified that one category. You could add other things like interceptor missiles, offensive long range missiles. I mean, we can't produce a shred of what we need, a fraction of it. But at the same time, we are focused on, and one of the reasons why I think that we're behind this and okay with not having this war come to an end, because it keeps the trough open for the defense industrial base.
Oh, yeah.
Here's a couple of recent articles that really put the graphic number on it. First of all, in terms of the war in the Middle East, since October 7, 2023, it's been a big boon for the defense industrial base here. We've spent a total of $21 billion to allow Israel to continue fighting for now 2 years. And then you speak about this Yemen operation, the one we did in Iran, and some of the other areas that we have spent of our own, add another 10 to 12 billion, and you're talking about nearly $33 billion that we have spent on that alone. And of course, all that has to go into making new missiles, etc. That's in the Middle East. Now then, we jump to the Russia-Ukraine war. So we're going back 3.5 years. Trump often uses this weird number, $350 billion the U.S. has spent. There's no rationale. That's not true at all. The real number, though, is huge. It's $187 billion, and it goes into all these different categories of things that we have spent on there. So there is a lot of money, especially the biggest majority of that is $126 billion in military operations and funds and everything else, a majority of which goes back to the U.S. defense industrial base. So everywhere you look, that's going there. Now then, you look overall, and Gary put that third one up there, the profits of war, the top beneficiaries from 2020 through 2024, 54%, of $4.4 trillion, went to military contractors. War is good business for the contractors. It doesn't matter that they're not producing the stuff we would actually need if we have to fight a war. It only matters that the bottom line, which they, of course, richly reward all of those members of Congress and any other politicians or any of these other former four-star generals that we, you know, warn you about all the time, that's where a lot of this money goes. And then there you have it. So that's it's so short-sighted.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, it's... to sing the song briefly from Cabaret, money makes the world go round. I lived next door when I was living in Bethesda to the largest defense lobbyist in D.C. Good guy. I mean, he was a good neighbor. He was completely incapable of fixing anything around his house. I mean, when he get a clogged toilet, his wife would call me up to come over and unclog the toilet. Okay, it was that bad. He didn't even know how to jump start a car, but he did know how to sign up General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, all the Raytheon, and he knew how to hold fundraisers for members of Congress. And to hold these fundraisers to give those members of Congress a nice big fat check. And then when he would call those members of Congress, they'd pick the phone up and say, "Hey there, how are you doing? And what do you need?" And he'd tell them what he needs, tell them what his customers need. And that member of Congress, happy to do it. He didn't do it for all 535. No, no, no. You go for the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. Yep. You're bipartisan, man. Do the Democrats and the Republicans. Don't just go on one side. You got to play both sides of the aisle on this. And you do it for the Armed Services Committee. And you do it for you find those key committees that are going to be the ones who can actually sign the checks, appropriate the money, whatever. And That's been the Washington business. It really came into full blow, you know, its full glory about 35 years ago and under Bill Clinton. That's when this shift from the government doing itself internally to farming it out to contractors started. And it accelerated under George W. Bush, continued under Barack Obama, has continued under Donald Trump, you know, and the money, you can see the tangible evidence. Well, you know, you live there in Northern Virginia. You remember all the Lamborghini and Ferrari dealerships there were 35 years ago? No, because they didn't exist. They're there now.
They sure are there now.
Bentley and Rolls Royce have dealerships. Good God. You know, it's just so the money has it is nothing but a house of ill repute anymore in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and again, the double perverse, not only are we funneling away literally hundreds of billions of dollars to support two wars that are not in our national interest, that our security is not threatened, there's $200 billion. And look, I mean, you could just not get further into debt by not going down that path. You could use it on things that benefit Americans. And there's right. A whole laundry list of things that could have done that we, you know, we tell people, well, we can't do this. We don't have money. We can't do that. We can't help you out, but we are sending this stuff over here in places that are not where our security isn't it threatened, but it's making a whole lot of money for a very tiny fraction of a minority of the uber rich, et cetera.
Correct.
And yet it's not producing national security for us. To the contrary, even though we're spending a lot of this money, our stocks of the weapons that we would need, should we unexpectedly get into a war with China or unexpectedly get into a war with Russia, if we should stumble into either one of those, whether intentionally or a Pearl Harbor kind of thing somewhere else, we don't have the stocks of weapons because we keep giving them away faster than we can generate it with our very limited defense industrial base. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, again, the weapon system should be designed from a strategic point of view. In other words, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? And then you come up with the tactics. What do we need? What concrete steps do we need, or what things do we need in order to achieve this objective? So the example is, now we've created an air defense system that was built around an idea that the threat that we'd be facing was like one inbound plane or one inbound missile. And so, okay, so it's going to cost us $7 million per Patriot missile. I'm not talking about the whole unit. I mean, the whole unit, you're up into, you know, $30 million probably. But each missile that you fire, it's $7 million if it's the S-3. Well, and then normally it was designed, okay, we're going to fire these two at this, you know, $60 million aircraft that's coming in. Okay, that you can say, yeah, we'll spend $14 million to shoot down something that's $60 million. But now we're using it to shoot down $20,000, $50,000 drones that all of a sudden, you know, we're spending $14 million to defeat a $50,000 cost. And Russia can pump those out every day, you know, when they're firing 600 of those. And you figure, okay, we got to fire two for every one of those. That would be 1,200, except Lockheed Martin only makes 550, maybe 700 a year. Whoops. Right away, in one day, with one launch, you can completely wipe out the, you know, 2 years of production by the U.S. producer. And it's not confined just to the Patriot missile. We find the same thing with the THAAD system, the Terminal High Air Defense System. We find the same thing with the M1 Abrams tanks. We don't even build those new anymore. We take existing ones and refurbish them. Oh yeah, but it takes us 18 months to refurbish. I mean, good God, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like a real estate project in Florida. You know, they're notorious down here for starting and not getting them finished. So you can't point to a single weapons class, you know, like aircraft carriers. Yeah, man, we could build one in, three, 4 years. Icebreakers, we're 2 to 3 years out from there. F-35 jets, Oh, those are 18 months to 24 months. You know, across the board, it's as if they believe that we're in some ancient time where we got all the time in the world to worry about this. Meanwhile, what we've seen take place on the ground in Ukraine is extremely rapid transformation. 3 years, you know, 3 years ago when this war started, nobody was thinking about the drones becoming the dominant technology on the battlefield. Now you can't imagine the battlefield without the drones. And there's not just one type of drone. There are multiple types of drones. Everything from those that do intelligence and reconnaissance, those that are actually interceptors of other drones, those that are capable of carrying out attacks, suicide drones, and those that can actually drop explosives and go back and reload and come back again. And, you know, here's the United States trying to figure out, oh, yeah, we got to build some more drones, but you know, China's not happy with us right now. And they control all the key components. And I know what we'll do. We're going to piss on the Chinese some more. That'll teach them.
That'll help them. Yeah. That'll make them want to come across.
Yeah.
I want to pivot now in the time we have remaining here to look at where this is going and what some of the others in Europe. It's not all bad in Europe. You mentioned several at the top, and I want to show you just a couple things in just the last few days that there is some hope that there is rational thinkers still in Europe. And if we listen to them before it's too late, we still have a shot at avoiding the worst outcomes. First of all, let's go to Viktor Orban, who was ironically standing right next to, a Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk at a press conference recently, where he and Tusk had just talked about how we were basically in a hybrid war against Russia right before this happened. And here comes Orban, and they ask him a similar question. Is Russia your biggest threat?
Who's the main threat against Europe right now?
It's a provocation.
No, it's a real question. Please, Prime Minister.
The real danger, Europe, yeah. Economic stagnation and losing competitiveness. This is the danger.
Not Russia?
Sorry.
Not Russia?
No. We are stronger than... So we are stronger than Russia. Make some comparison and base your opinion on the facts. So we have more than 400 million people, yeah? Russia is 130-something. Look at the European GDP. It's like that. Russia is like that. We spend altogether 27 more on military spending than the Russians. So why we are afraid? We are stronger than they are. The question is whether we have...
I love you when you use my arguments.
Whether we have leadership to come together and to defend our interests together. That's what we should do anyway.
So now you can certainly nitpick that, yeah, you may have more people and more GDP, but in terms of military capacity, I'm not sure it's quite that way. But his bigger point certainly is the case. He says, I'm not worried about an attack from Russia. I'm worried about economic issues that we can have something to, some effect on and try to turn things around and not focus on a military strike over here at the expense of the economy here. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I don't think there's a single country in Europe right now that has a growth rate above 1.5%. Of GDP. So the economies are stagnant across the board. The debt situation is growing worse, particularly in countries, you know, the big three, France, Germany, and the UK, even though the UK exited from the European Union, the so-called Brexit, it is still a de facto member of that European community. But the real issue in throughout Europe is the political division. I mean, take Poland as an example. Here is Donald Tusk, the prime minister, who is pretty aggressive vis-a-vis Russia. But the new Polish president Nawrocki, he's the exact opposite. So you don't even have consensus in a lot of these countries. It's interesting that Orban likes to look at Europe as a block, but it's not. It's very, very much fragmented. Meanwhile, Russia is the fourth largest economy in the world now, as measured by purchasing power parity under gross domestic product. So, Russia is definitely not even weak on the economic front. But Orban at least is in the camp and recognizes it's a fool's errand to get into a military fight with Russia at this point, because Europe can't sustain it.
or looking for something else. There is even more of an issue aside just from the economic part here, and that is and Orban has said these in other comments that he's, you know, definitely against even talking about military operations against Russia. He has no interest in it, it would be a foolish issue to go down. From Slovakia, Robert Fico, in an address to a lot of veterans at a war memorial on October the 5th, so just a few days ago, he was pretty almost emotional about saying how dumb it was. He was talking about, just to set up his comments here, he was talking about how what real war was been like. Apparently this was a World War II memorial that he was speaking from here, and he gave some stories about what the real cost to Slovakia was in World War II. And then he says, why in God's name would we want to go with a new war here and now?
Sa z Európskej únie stáva nie mierová sila, ale vojnová sila. A priznajme si to, že viacej hovoríme na pôde Európskej únie o vojne, ako hovoríme o mier. Priznajme si, aké obrovské chyby robíme v poslednom období. Oznamujem každému, kto má tak strašne rád vojnu, že to nie je počítačová hra. Nie, že si zahrám pol hodinu nejaký zaujímavý príbeh na počítači a potom si pôjdem sadnúť do kaviarne. A teraz si predstavte, že ležíte tu niekde 5. oktobra ráno o 5. hodine v polmetrovom blate s prestreleným bruchom. Maximálne ku vám môže prísť zdravotník a vám urobí červený krížik na čelo, že sa s vami už neráta. Prosím, nenarábajme takto ľahko s vojnou. Nenarábajme s ňou ako s niečím, čo je normálne. A ešte sa nás pýtajú, ako chcete motivovať mladých slovenských ľudí, aby išli do vojny. A do akej vojny máme ísť? Aká tu je vojna? Kto nás ohrozuje? Slovensko nemá ani morálny, ani historický, ani právny dôvod uvažovať o akomkoľvek vojenskom dobrodružstve. A odporúčame Európskej únie, aby takú istú energiu, akú venuje dnes vojne, venovala ukončeniu vojny na Ukrajine, lebo v jej rukách to je. A opäť si stojím za svojimi slovami, že je to často úsilie viacerých štátov Európskej únie, ktorú tú vojnu podporujú. A táto vojna už dávno, dávno mohla skončiť.
So he was really emphatic there about saying, you know, here's the real cost of war. He actually, in the middle of that, he also talked about, he says, listen, when I was, they attempted to assassinate me and I got shot. I mean, I had all this great care. They took me on a helicopter and all this kind of stuff and I got fixed up. But he said, imagine if you're in a war. And that's when he shifted to that part. He said, you know, just a regular person in just some red common town, all of a sudden you get shot and they're just like saying, you're done because we don't have the capacity. That's what war is doing. And then he said, why should I try to talk my young people into going to a war? And then you see him. He said, what war? What are you even talking about? And so that, I think, is not just in Slovakia. And tell me what you think about this, because I think you see this kind of thing extending all over other places. I think you mentioned the Czech Republic. Lots of people are going, why in the hell should we have a war with Russia?
Right. Well, and let's assume that there's an incident and someone tries to get Article 5 enacted. Well, my understanding of how Article 5 works is every country first internally to that country has to vote. Yeah, we're going to go to war. Well, right off the bat, we know that you're going to get a no vote out of Slovakia, a no vote out of the Czech Republic, and no vote out of Hungary. So right off the bat, you don't have unity in NATO to go forward with that. You've also now got the situation's turning in Poland because they now realize they've lost 10,000, a minimum of 10,000 Poles have been killed in the Ukraine war. And, you know, they want to send more into that meat grinder, go ahead. But, you know, that's starting to get some pushback there. So this war talk on the part of Europe, I don't dismiss it as irrelevant, but they also run up against just the very practical reality of they don't have the military force in place to do anything. They don't have the depth of resources that if they decide to get involved to sustain the activity. So, you know, it's like wanting to be a professional fighter. And, you know, you're going to go for a 15-round fight, but you can't last the first minute in the ring. You run out of gas. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm out of breath. That's Europe.
But meanwhile, I'm talking smack to that guy who's been doing his training. That's the other half of this.
Yeah. I mean, it's just it's bizarre. But that's where I come back to this. I think these people are being driven by some, let's call it, hidden financial interests. Because ultimately, I believe all of this is always about money. It's always the money, and who's getting rich and who's getting impoverished. And these leaders don't care if it bankrupts their countries, just as long as, you know, they're taken care of. And you know, Russia and Putin in particular, to his credit, they're being very patient. They're not getting emotional, but they are pushing the accelerator pedal down to the bottom of the car. It's a pedal to the metal now, and you're seeing this offense is just, it's picking up momentum as it's moving along the entire front.
And that kind of leads us kind of to the last point I want to talk about. However, Europe isn't actually, and in Europe and in the West in general, to include us, is not ready to sustain any kind of a combat,
right,
in conflict. Yet we still keep making these, use your fighter analogy, we're still making all these cocky comments like, you know, we're a heavyweight fighter who's been doing training against another heavyweight fighter, but we can't go more than one round. And yet the other fighter who actually can go 15 rounds is sitting there thinking, how much longer am I going to listen to this, especially if any actions start happening? And here is, to your point here, here is Vladimir Putin just a couple of days ago talking about where their objectives still are.
I address the soldiers and officers, the real heroes of our time, with a special feeling. I thank you for your loyalty to your motherland, for your military valor and courage, for every day of your hard combat work. I am sure that, thanks to you, the security of Russia will be reliably ensured, and the long-awaited and strong world will return to the heroic land of Donbass and Novorossiya. We are together, and this means that all our plans will be realized.
So he's saying, listen, we have been talking about the four oblasts plus Crimea and what's on the table right now. But if we keep fighting, he said there, we'll get all of Novorossiya, not just the Donbass. And you right. see that there are five additional oblasts that would include, that currently includes what's Novorossiya. How serious do you think Putin was on that? Or was that a slip of the tongue?
Nope, dead serious. So that means Kharkiv, Sumy, Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk,
Odessa and Mykolaiv, I think.
Nikolaev, and then Odessa. Yeah. No, that's where it's going to end. It's no hyperbole. That's where it's headed. And the West can... they can deny it. They can jump up and down. They can hold their breath till they turn blue. It's not going to change the situation on the ground. The only thing that could potentially change it is if we decided to try to engage Russia in a nuclear war. Okay. Yeah. Nobody comes out a winner on that end.
Yeah.
So Putin, you know, they've been clear. They were willing to settle this 3.5 years ago by allowing Ukraine to keep the Donetsk and Luhansk.
Yeah.
And we told them to screw off. So, okay, now we're going to take what we want. Now we're going to get what satisfies us. And not a thing the West could do to stop it.
And toward that end, there was also a meeting on the same, one of the same days where Vladimir Putin was making some of these comments. Valery Gerasimov, the commander of the armed forces of Ukraine, was asked, what is the current status of our armed forces? Now, as I show you this video, just so people aren't caught off guard here, there is some pretty remarkable new technology that can translate a video into your own language. But now then they have something, and I've seen this work in both directions just in the last 2 days, actually, to where it looks like he's actually speaking English. So I don't want to catch anybody off guard. That was part of the... they call it an AI generator, but I've seen this. This is actually genuinely Gerasimov talking, now translated into English.
The enemy has concentrated its main efforts on stabilizing the situation in crisis areas of the front in order to slow down our advance. The North troop grouping is operating along the border zone and continues to carry out tasks to create a security belt in the Kharkiv and Sumy regions of Ukraine. Its units are also successfully advancing in the southern part of Volchansk. The West grouping is completing the rout of the enemy in the southern districts of Kupiansk, successfully advancing in the Krasno-Liman direction, and the liberation of the settlement of Yampol continues, most of which is under our forces' control. The troops of the southern grouping, despite the enemy's stubborn resistance, are advancing through fierce fighting in the cities of Seversk and Konstantinovka.
Now, if anybody should say, well, yeah, he can say whatever he wants. We see Sersky says a lot of stuff. Zelensky says a lot of stuff. Let me show you a couple of things, the key areas here. These are progress on the ground here. This area is our area around Avanivka. I want to point this out. Just so you can see the context here. This is in the southern part of the Eastern Front. People who've been watching our show know that there was a counteroffensive conducted by the Ukraine side a couple of months back where they took nearly all of this and shoved Russia back. And as we warned at the time, it was only a temporary situation. Russia was certainly going to reestablish, and now they have almost completely recovered everything that was lost. And so now Ukraine has simply lost more troops, both in the offensive and then now in the defensive, pushed back again. So that was a net loss for the Ukraine. Then we come up here into Pokrovsk, and you see now Russia has almost half of the city. It's now well into the city almost half, to include the citadel in the southern part here, one of the key areas. Once this citadel falls, there's not much left to be able to, I think there's one more high-rise area right here, and then the rest of it is all low-rise stuff, which could be falling shortly after that. You saw that the Ukraine side tried to have a counteroffensive to cut off this penetration that Russia made back in August. That failed as well. And now then what they had gained is also being lost back there. Then we come up to Konstantinivka. Russia continues to move up on the southern flank of into the city of that. And then the other area I want to point to is where'd it go here? Sorry, get it up here. Yeah, into the Kupiansk area. And now then you see Ukraine again try to counterattack to cut off this penetration. When it first happened, they were unsuccessful. And now then Russia is beginning to completely saturate. And now you see more than half of the city of Kupiansk is now under full Russian control or in the gray zone, and now rock back. There's hardly any areas where Ukraine is just fully in control. Every one of these areas keep going on. And he mentioned the northern, where they have in this Kharkiv area, there's parts here and here, and then in the Sumy area up here, they have maintained that. So everywhere you want to look, Russia on the ground continues to attrit the Ukraine side. And of course, the biggest problem for that is that they caught the troops. That's the biggest loss. The territory loss. Sorry, the territory loss is one thing, but it's the human capital that cannot be replaced. Doesn't matter how many more bombs, bullets, and drones, or even long range missiles. It doesn't matter any of that if you don't have the manpower on the ground. And Russia is slowly just destroying the Ukrainian armed forces. I can't hear you there, Larry.
I said it's advance and attrit. So what's underway right now with Russia, if you ask Western sources, they'll say that Russia has 2 million reserves. I talked to Stas Krapivnik. I think you've talked to Stanislav before. You know, he did 11 years as a major in the U.S. Army, now lives in Russia. He says Russian actual reserves are 32 million. They've got 32 million former soldiers that they could call back into service. And I thought, wow, that's quite a number. But he says, you know, Russia's not there yet. Russia has, they have not applied their maximum force to this effort yet. And this takes us back to the Tomahawk discussion. If the United States crosses that bridge, begins using the Tomahawk, you're going to see Russia move militarily into a new level of activity. So.
And in fact, let me ask you on that to see if any of your sources corroborate. I've heard just in the last few days, actually the last couple of weeks, but it heightened in the last 24 hours, that apparently there are more and more grumbling going on inside of Russia, displeasure at Vladimir Putin, not for conducting the war, but for being too soft and not pushing harder on it. You said they had the pedal to the metal, but a lot of Russians are complaining the pedal isn't pushed far enough down and they're putting pressure on him to do so. What are you hearing on that?
Yeah, the same. That's what the insanity of all of this is from the standpoint of the West, that we've got to get rid of Putin. You get rid of Putin, all of a sudden, you're going to have something far more difficult to deal with. So it's just, it's craziness.
And so the implication being, and by the way, many on the West are saying one of the reasons why the West is so emboldened to even like the U.S. to talk about bringing on Tomahawk missiles, or Ursula von der Leyen to talk about, yeah, let's do more things. Macron, Merz, all those folks, that they keep pushing the war narrative here because they don't think Russia can do anything. What they've seen this, you may recall about a month or so ago, Emmanuel Macron literally mocked Russia openly and said in the last 2 years, they've only taken 1% of the territory. You're focused on the territory, but because they're not thinking about it, they don't know or don't understand the consequence of the attrition part that's going on there. But still, they see that it's still only 1%, even with all these losses, because that's all Russia can do. And question is that all they can do, or is that all they are doing right now? Which is it?
Yeah, no, not even close. And look, the reality is this. That figure they use, oh, they've only taken 1%. They're using the entirety of Ukrainian territory. Use the territory that's east of the Dnieper, and then figure out what percentage you come up with. You find it tells a very, very different story. But Russia's not guided by, they're not saying, oh my God, we've got to capture this much territory by such and such date, or we're done. Just the opposite. We're going to demilitarize Ukraine. And what they've discovered in the course of the last 3.5 years, they're demilitarizing NATO at the same time. It's a twofer. You know, it's one of those buy one, get one free deals. So they're going to continue doing what they're going to do. And if the West continues to provoke, then Russia is going to intensify its military activity. And the West has no response. That's the bottom line.
We got a question here from one of our viewers here. It says, what natural barriers exist between the Dnieper River and advancing fronts? Could the war end at the next physical barriers? What do the fronts look like next year? Any ideas?
Yeah, you know, I think by next year, Russia will be in Kiev and Odessa.
That's a pretty bold statement.
Yeah, and they'll be up. They will have captured all territory that's east of the Dnieper.
Well, I mean, that's... That would require a pretty big change because regardless of the attrition, whatever, they have only taken 1% of the total. And even if you look at just what's east of the Dnieper, it's been relatively small. That would be a lot bigger in a relatively short period of time. What makes you think that they could actually do that?
Because you're going to have a collapse of Ukrainian manpower. They can't sustain it. And the West isn't getting richer. United States isn't rolling in dough. Where our debt to GDP ratio is skyrocketing. Same with France. Same with the UK. Same with Germany. So nobody's going to have the money. You know, they're going to be writing checks on bank accounts that are broke. So there's no way to sustain this. So it's going to reach a breaking point. But you know, by the end of 2026, you know, I think this will definitely be over. This is not one that's going to stretch on for years. The West simply does not have the juice or the fuel in its tanks to sustain it.
And the Ukraine doesn't have the manpower to even if you had the juice. But it's just unfortunate that the only way to prove that is to just continue to destroy the future generations of Ukrainian men that they're going to need to rebuild after this is over. I think going to be looked back on one of the more egregious violations of just human nature that the West will have to answer for, that all these things were, the fundamentals were there. They should have been known. And yet they continue to sacrifice thousands upon thousands of Ukrainian men pointlessly per week. It's egregious.
Yeah. It's a sin, against humanity.
That's the best way to put it. Well, listen, as always, we really appreciate you coming on and providing such clarity and information on things that we aren't getting through other sources there. We really value that. And thank you so much for coming on today.
Hey, thanks, Danny. I'm going to have to jump. I got a date with Pepe Escobar.
Well, good. Well, look forward to watching that later also. To send people there to look at your channel there also. But also to let you know that we have Dr. Gilbert, Dr. Rowe. He has some things to say that some people might not agree with, and some people could be upset about, and some people could really like. So be sure and tune in to hear what he has to say today. One of the voices that gives the truth as he sees it, and that's one of the things we're predicated on. So join us this afternoon, 3:00 Eastern Time on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and we will see you then.